This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. Today on The Breakfast Grill, I have with me Richard Schmalensi, the Howard J. Johnson Professor of Management and Economics and one of the world's leading scholars on the new economics of multi-sided platforms. Professor Schmalensi, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. Welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Good morning.
So you've co-authored this new book, Matchmakers, explaining how multi-sided platforms work best in practice, why they do what they do, and how entrepreneurs can improve their chances for success. So let's start with the basics. Now, what I understand multi-sided platforms to be, essentially they are matchmaking one group of customers with a group of interested parties. Is that a correct way of describing multi-sided platforms?
Yeah, we say it's a device or a business or an enterprise or whatever that makes it easier for two groups that want to interact to do so and makes a little money in the process usually.
Okay, so give us examples of how that works.
Let's take an old example, a newspaper. A newspaper assembles eyeballs for advertisers. It bribes readers with content and delivers them to advertisers. So it connects advertisers to readers. Now, readers don't necessarily want to connect to advertisers, but advertisers surely want to connect with readers. And newspapers and magazines and advertiser-supported media are just ways of facilitating that interaction. Payment cards are another old example. They make it easier for merchants and customers to connect and do business. Stock exchanges, securities exchanges, again, make it easier for those who want to buy and sell and those who want to provide liquidity to interact.
So these are really old business models. I mean, you're talking about print, for instance, a sunset industry, as many has called it. So
So
we're not talking about some new business model here.
No, we're not talking about a new business model, and that's a point that we stress. It's not a new business model. What's new is the way that model can take advantage of all kinds of new technologies, broadband in particular, the internet, the cloud, all the advances in information and communications technology that make it easier to connect people. And matchmakers connect. So all of a sudden, you can have a company like Uber sitting in San Francisco connecting riders and drivers in Brussels, Belgium. Google can do billions of searches. The level of activity, of connectivity, is just unimaginable even 20 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. So that's what's new. What's new is the technology, not the model.
You say in your book that this was a business model that not a lot of economists or business schools had paid attention to. Why did you say that?
Well, we said it in part because of our own history. So David and I studied payment systems, wrote a book, two editions, and we didn't think of it. We thought of it as a special case. And then we wrote a book on operating systems, computer operating systems, and we thought, you know, that's a special case. Our friend and colleague Jean Tirole, along with a colleague of his, wrote a paper saying, you know, these special cases are examples of multi-sided platforms. He called them two-sided markets. I don't like the term because it's a descriptor of a business, not of a market. But and that was mentioned in his Nobel Prize citation. And, you know, I and others said, I should have seen that. I studied these things for 20 years, and I didn't realize they were all part of the same story. And since that paper, which was published in 2000, or a little after, actually written in 2000, there's been a huge explosion of economists studying multi-sided platforms. As we all realize, you know, they've been all around us, and they are special.
And because of technology, it's become so profitable now to be in this business of being in a multi-sided platform.
Well, it can be profitable. Most people who start these businesses fail, of course, like most other businesses. But these businesses in particular are tricky. And we emphasize that. If you're in the business of connecting people in Group A to people in Group B, you don't have a business for people in Group A unless you've got people in Group B on board.
Right.
And you don't have a business for people in B unless you've got A on board. So there's so many business models that work beautifully once you've got enough people on both sides or enough customers on both sides, but that can't get off the ground. That we stress that, the ignition problem. How do you get the critical mass? Mm. How do you get enough customers so that you're actually attractive? Once you're attractive, off you go. But until you get enough to be attractive, you've got nothing.
And you've been studying this as part of your research for your book. Talk to us about the companies that have failed to get that critical mass and to get the ignition that is needed to be successful.
Well, one example we stress, because it had so much hype in the U.S., was business-to-business exchanges. The idea was, oh, it'll be easier for buyers to find sellers and for sellers to find buyers if all this happens online. Well, one problem was, at least in the U.S. economy, buyers and sellers could find each other pretty easily. There wasn't a big problem to be solved. And then sellers didn't actually like to be online competing with other sellers because that intensified price competition. So you didn't get many sellers signing up because they could find buyers without needing to go to the exchange. And from buyers' point of view, there weren't any sellers. So why are they interested? So they died. All of them died. There were, well, not all of them. A couple have survived by adapting very specialized strategies. Take a counterexample. Take Alibaba. Mm-hmm. In China, there were real problems doing business-to-business exchanges. You didn't have transport. You didn't have credit markets. You didn't have a legal system. You just didn't have information. Alibaba solved a big problem. And as a result, people signed up, and Alibaba is now Alibaba.
What comparisons do you see between Alibaba and Amazon in the way both are multi-sided platforms?
Well, that's an interesting question. They started off in very different ways, right? Alibaba started off solving that business-to-business problem. Amazon started off not as a multi-sided platform. Amazon started off as a retailer. Amazon started off as an online bookstore. And the advantage they had was selection. And then they began to operate as a shopping mall. So that's how they solved the ignition problem, how they solved the getting started problem. Once you're a successful merchant, you have a flow of customers. And then you can say to other people, wouldn't you like to use our platform to buy and sell? Mm. So they had one side of the market on board, so to speak, once they had a customer base. Then they could go to merchants and say, we're now a mall. Would you like to be in our mall? So very different. Amazon is fundamentally a B2C platform now. Alibaba has B2C elements, of course, but they start important ones, but they started off as B2B. It's really important, particularly when people try something new, to really understand the setting and the consumers and who cares about price and all of these details. Things work in different settings differently.
How does a matchmaker determine what price can attract the critical mass that you talk about?
Well, it's tricky. You really have to ask the question, who needs whom and how badly? Take newspapers, to take an old example. Advertisers want readers. Readers don't want advertisers. So in a situation like that, the readers are going to be subsidized. You're going to sell to readers at or below cost. Advertisers are going to pay the freight. I often use a restaurant reservation service that we talk about in our book.
Open Table?
Open Table, which exists in KL, but boy, hasn't penetrated much, has five restaurants according to its website.
It's very big in the U.S.
In Boston, it has 740 plus restaurants. So we'll see how well they do in KL. But anyway, they charge restaurants. They don't charge diners. And that's sort of the obvious model because I can always pick up a phone and call the restaurant. It's a hassle, but they're doing less for me than they're doing for the restaurant because when I show up at a restaurant, they're making, depending on the restaurant, a significant amount of money on me. So the restaurant will pay a dollar for me to show up. what do I pay? What will I pay for the convenience? Not much. And in fact, I get a negative price. They give me rewards. For some matchmakers, it's obvious. If you're going to do an online magazine, mm-hmm. you're probably going to make money on the advertising, not on the readers. That's the model for those sorts of businesses. That's straightforward. For others, it's less clear.
So the businesses that fail at this, is it a matter of trial and error to get the pricing right?
Usually it's a matter of not getting critical mass, not getting enough people. It can be a matter of trial and error, but more commonly, if you're a novel business, it's a matter of not finding a way to get off the ground. Again, we talked about OpenTable in the book. OpenTable burned cash for years trying to find a way to get restaurants and diners both using its platform. It lost money for a good 3 years. They were about to shut down. They changed strategy. They made it, but not a simple task often.
I'm speaking to Professor Richard Schmalansi, co-author of Matchmakers, The New Economics of Multi-Sided Platforms. After this, we discuss matchmakers as disruptors to existing industries. Stay tuned right here on BFM 89.9. Good morning. Today on The Breakfast Grill, I'm speaking to Professor Richard Schmalansi. He has served as the Dean of the MIT Sloan School of Management for 9 years and as a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. His new book, Matchmakers, explains the economics of multi-sided platforms, and that's what we're discussing this morning on The Breakfast Grill. So, Professor, you've talked a little bit about ignition and the importance to get off the ground. Now, once you've got people using, it's easier to add to that, but the initial bit, the ignition bit is where most businesses fail, and you've argued that in your book. What is that pivotal point that some matchmakers make it and others don't?
Well, it's a matter of strategy. Sometimes it's a matter of luck. People use a whole set of different approaches. In the early days of credit cards, the first payment card, Diners Club, they mailed cards to people in a wealthy part of New York. And then they went to restaurants and said, do you know how many people, how many rich people have these cards? That got the restaurants on board. It's now illegal to mail credit cards in the U.S.
That's a sneaky way to do it.
So, you know, the people would intercept the mails, and it was fraud, and it was a lot of fun. But everybody uses different strategies. OpenTable's launch strategy, once they figured that they had to focus on one or two cities, was to get software into restaurants below cost, and then they could go to consumers. Very often, it's a matter of starting with one side, subsidizing that side and using the other side. They subsidized the table management software that restaurants had to have. And once they had it, they could go to customers and say, to consumers and say, look how many restaurants you can reserve tables at. Yeah. So it really does vary. I think we have the reference to this video of the guys who launched YouTube. And they talk about, they had this great technology, and their strategy was, you know, when we get enough people to upload videos and enough people to watch videos, then we can sell to advertisers. So we have to get those two groups on board. Mm-hmm. And they're sitting around, about three or four of them, and they're just beating their heads against the wall. They offered money to pretty girls to post videos. That didn't work. They posted a video of one of the guys at the zoo that turned out to be cute. They got their friends to watch that. But their growth story is it just bounces and bounces and bounces. And then their activity ticks up. And then in this online seminar, they then change the scale of the graph and it goes zoom. So that was luck. That was luck. They had the right technology. They had the right idea. So did a lot of other people. They were not the only people who understood the technology. They were not the only people who saw the business. They were the only people who managed to get off the ground.
Are all matchmakers set to be disruptors of established industries?
Well, they can be. I mean, if you think about, in a way, the industries most vulnerable for disruption are themselves matchmakers, right? The way shopping malls in the United States have been disrupted to some extent by online retails. Newspapers, matchmakers, have been disrupted by online advertising. So enterprises that are in the matchmaking business but not doing it terribly well are going to be very vulnerable to businesses that do it better. Taxi companies disrupted by Uber and on and on and on. So they can disrupt industries.
What do you think is ripe for disruption next? I mean, based on your experience, based on your research from this book, what do you think is ripe for the next disruption?
What we point to, and it's an ongoing disruption, and it's not going to be A is replaced by B, is retailing. Right? Retailing is just changing. But the pattern of change is complicated. At least in the U.S., foot traffic in stores is down. Purchasing isn't down. So people are shopping online, maybe buying in stores. Well, maybe you don't need as big a store. Well, maybe you can show things online differently. Do you need to be a platform online? Zappos, the shoe store, started out as a platform online, found that customers were complaining about different levels of service quality from different providers, so they became an ordinary merchant. They buy shoes and sell shoes. So it isn't just that platforms disrupt. The technology provides a lot of options. So I think retailing is going to be an ongoing disruption for a while. Lots of people point to financial services.
Yes, fintech as a disruption.
I'm a little bit of a skeptic only because financial services are so heavily regulated and they're so complicated. And I'm a veteran of the payment space. And I would say every year there are five new enterprises that are going to replace Visa, and they die. So I think there is a lot of room in financial services, but I don't see that as happening quickly. You know, we talk in the book, and I'll bore you by repeating it, that we think this is going to be a lot like electricity. Electricity took a long time to have its full effect. You had the first central generating station in 1880-something, and we didn't really get past streetlights and streetcars until the 20s. It took people a while to say, oh, we can make small motors. Oh, we can put small motors there. Oh, we can do this. So I think there's going to be a lot of creative thinking about what this business model and the new technologies enable. But the place that we see just ongoing right now is retail, and it's fascinating, and nobody knows the answer.
If you've just joined us on The Breakfast Grill, I'm speaking to Professor Richard Smolansky, the Howard J. Johnson Professor of Management and Economics, and one of the world's leading scholars on the new economics of multi-sided platforms.
I would also add, by the way, that I serve as co-chairman of the Board of Governors of the Asia School of Business, just to make a local plug,
which is why I'm in KL. So you are co-chair with Tansri Dr. Zaki Akhtar Aziz, and this is in collaboration with MIT Sloan School of Management, the Asia School of Business right here in KL. So what are the plans for the ASB here in KL?
Well, we've admitted our first class this fall, 48 people from 11 countries, quite an extraordinary group. We're going to have a lot of the program taught initially by MIT faculty as we build up the local faculty. We have a classroom building and residential buildings not under construction yet, but in the last stages of design and fully funded. So we're going to build for this region a world-class business school. And what MIT gets out of it is we get engaged in a very important region of the world.
How do you see the business school landscape here in Asia at the moment?
We call it the Asia School of Business because it is in and to a very important extent for Asia. I think the region's growth and the region's prospects and the region's scale are going to attract students from all over the world. We don't view ASB as a vehicle for people to study to then go work in the U.S. and Europe. we think it's a vehicle for people to study and work in this region. And, you know, Malaysia is our largest source of students in this first class, and the U.S. is the second largest. So those students are coming here to learn the region, to work in the region, and to contribute to the region.
So B-schools in the age of startups.
Ah, yes.
Talk to me about what you think. I mean, are B-schools still relevant in the age of disruptors and matchmakers and startups?
Yes, they are. But it's not your father's business school or your grandfather's business school. In the old days, the real old days, business schools focused on case studies of established companies. That's not so interesting anymore. We then tried to focus on helping people understand basic principles, what basic economic theory, strategic principles, finance, marketing. And that's still important. But increasingly, and particularly at MIT Sloan and here at ASB, we emphasize the sort of entrepreneurial culture, the entrepreneurial style, learning how to take risks on a small budget, how to be creative, how to build teams. And that's an important, in a way, new dimension of business schools. The ASB is going to emphasize action learning, where students get out into companies, some of them startups. We do at MIT Sloan, we do a lot of student studies in startups, and we're going to do more here. Take classroom learning into a company, apply it, come back and talk about what you've learned. Did it work? Didn't it work? Go out again, come back. We've used that design in executive programs. We use it increasingly in the MBA program at MIT Sloan, and it's going to be central here at ASB. And the curriculum is going to emphasize innovation and entrepreneurship. I think, particularly for this region, which can benefit from and has the potential to benefit from a lot of innovation and entrepreneurship, this is a good fit.
Right.
It's designed to fit.
So when did you start to see that shift away from the old traditional B-school model to being cognizant of the new economy?
Well, I think it varies from place to place, frankly. MIT as a whole has been a hotbed of entrepreneurship for a long time. We have Nobel Prize winners who've started multiple companies. So that notion that you invent it and then you take it out is part of the MIT culture, and so it's been part of the MIT Sloan culture. We had an entrepreneurship center based in Sloan but operating across MIT at some point in the early 90s. It was before I became dean. So we've been at this a long time, and that knowledge is coming here.
So, Professor, what are you going to be focusing on now? I mean, you've written this book. Now you're working with ASB. What excites you for the future?
Well, I'm excited by a lot of these matchmaking industries and look forward to working with people in them. I also work in other areas, so I'm a little bit of a dilettante. I'm doing some work in energy and so forth, but energy is interesting also because, let me just say this, the retail electricity system now has a lot more communication technology. You have distributed energy resources. You have the possibility of a really disruptive change there, and I find that fascinating.
I've been speaking to Professor Richard Schmalansi, co-author of Matchmakers, The New Economics of Multi-Sided Platforms. He's also the co-chair of the Asia School of Business here in KL, a business school established by Bank Negara in collaboration with MIT Sloan. Thank you so much for being on The Breakfast Grill. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
I'm Melissa Idris for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.